This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you.
This is the People Speak Radio Show with your host JT on BBS Radio Network. And we're talking with our special guest, Christopher Langan. Mr. Langan is considered to be the smartest man in America and possibly the world. We welcome Mr. Langan to the show, and he believes in God in an unusual way, through logic and without faith. And he has developed the Langan's theory of everything, the cognitive theoretical model of the universe. Now, he has thought much and has much to say, and I think we should just get right into it. Now, Chris, I once heard it said that people don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. So I want to ask you about the real human Chris Langan. Who are you? What motivates you? What makes you tick?
Well, I'd have to say I'm kind of a monomaniac. I really always wanted to understand the deep nature of reality. And that's the direction in which I headed from a very early age. And even now, that more or less lights my fire. That's what makes me tick. Of course, you know, I've got a ranch. I do ranch work. I go grocery shopping. I do things other people do. But I never feel fully comfortable until I'm back in front of my desk doing what I love, which is investigating the nature of reality.
Okay, now, thank you. Now, I understand you have ideas as to how to improve our world going forward. I would be very interested in hearing those as an introductory.
Okay, well, one of the main ideas that we have, we're approaching a juncture. And this is really a bifurcation. It's into possible futures. One of those futures will take us toward a centralized form of government. It's more or less like a hive. A certain cohort of elites are going to be in charge, and everybody else is going to be, they'll be the overclass, and everybody else will be a kind of underclass, which serves them and does pretty much what they're told. On the other hand, we can go in another direction, which is to distribute responsibility and decision-making power over everybody. And, of course, that takes enhanced intelligence and responsibility. So there's a certain amount of a certain challenge associated with this application. We have to make up our minds very quickly how we're going to do this. If we want to distribute responsibility, then the first thing that we need is a sound understanding of human nature and the nature of reality. And this is what I propose to bring.
A sound understanding of human nature. That sounds very interesting. Can you tell me about that? And I'm also interested in how well your cognitive theoretic model of the universe is being received, and how we might be able to forward that into the public's attention even better than it is now.
As far as how the CTMU is being received, I take it you know that academia is more or less a closed circle. It's, I guess you can imagine a circle of people with their left hands in their neighbor's pockets and their right hands pointing at each other. They don't point to anybody outside the circle. All they do is sight each other. And if you're not already in the circle, it's very, very difficult to break in there because, of course, everybody has his hand in his neighbor's pocket. And this militates against the acceptance of any new theory by any academic outsider. And so the CTMU it's out there. And the good thing about it is, however, that there's no academic on earth that can do anything about it. It's absolutely certain. It qualifies as absolute truth. As for how it relates to human nature, it shows that human nature and reality are pretty much the same thing. In other words, they coincide distributively over the entire universe. And this is, of course, a very complex, it leads to complex entailments and hence my theory of reality, CTMU.
Okay, now you spoke of this little word called truth. Can you tell me what truth is, and is it relative or absolute?
Well, truth is, along with falsehood, it makes up something called a classifier or a distinction. It is something that can be assigned to attributions, including perceptions and expressions of cognition. That basically tells us what is included in reality and what isn't. In other words, true corresponds to real, false corresponds to unreal. And this makes it a classifier. And mathematically speaking, it's what would be called classifier. And metaphysics is a language that contains classifiers that allow it to characterize what reality is. What was your other question?
I think you answered that. Well, okay. Is it relative? I'm not sure.
It's both. It's both relative and absolute. On lower levels, it's relative. And, of course, what relativity means is that things are defined on each other. For example, in Einstein's theory of relativity, velocities are defined on each other. You have a velocity only relative to the frame of another observer. Otherwise, your velocity is simply zero. But on higher levels, truth has to be defined with more and more of what is called invariance, until finally, on the very highest level, truth is absolutely invariant or absolute. So that's the nature of truth. Stratified, on lower levels, it's relative. On higher levels, it's absolute.
Okay, well, I'm going to encourage you to sort of dumb it down for me, if nobody else, because you speak a few notches above me, I have to admit. But, you know, I once understood you as saying that you're closer to absolute truth than any man has ever been before you. And so I wonder, well, as mere creatures, can we be absolutely certain of anything? And if so, what?
Well, yes, we can. We can be certain of truth itself, absolute truth. Logic is a set of rules. It's really the rules of valid cognition. And those are what we are certain of when we... truth is the identity of logic. Logic consists of... propositional logic consists of tautological axioms that basically define truth. And truth, conversely, defines logic. So if you believe in logic, you believe in truth. If you believe that logic is absolute, you believe that truth is absolute. And on the other hand, if you want to argue with logic and say, well, it's fuzzy or many-valued or we really can't get to the bottom of it, then you undermine your own position because it stops you from proving or verifying anything. You might as well not speak.
Okay.
Because nothing you say is identifiable, can be distinguished from its logical negation or complement.
Okay, well, if you've just joined us, this is the People Speak Radio Show with your host, JT, on BBS Radio Network. And we're talking with our guest, Christopher Langan. Now, Mr. Langan, I would like to know your account for free will. I'd be interested in you defining it and then telling me how it works.
Okay, I guess the easiest way to define it would be to go back to the moment of creation, or the Big Bang, as it's sometimes called in the standard model of physics. The universe, at its moment of its inception, it has to potentialize, actually has to generate a potential for itself. In that potential, it is an actualization that is complemented, it has a logical complement, that which it is not. It is completely self-contained. In other words, it's undefined from the perspective of anything outside it. As a matter of fact, there is no outside perspective, which makes it undefined, right? It's got to define itself completely internally. And this amounts to freedom. It is externally unconstrained. All of its constraint comes from within. It's self-determined. Now, this the universe is composed only of itself. There's nothing else but the universe, but the identity of the universe, to comprise the universe. So, of course, everything in the universe inherits this elementary kind of freedom, this external non-definition. And that is why we possess free will. We really can't get out of it. There's no way to claim that everything is determined because there's nothing external to the universe that would determine it or could determine it. You understand?
Oh, Okay, I think I might need to listen to that a few times before it completely soaks in. But thankfully, this show is recorded, so anybody who's listening now can get the recording and listen to it again, and I'm sure I will. So would you say in terms of free will that we are ultimately responsible for our actions and thoughts?
Well, that's the whole point. Without free will, there would be no such thing as responsibility. Everything would be completely determined in advance. And you really couldn't ascribe guilt or merit for anything that anybody might do because it was all determined in advance and they had no choice. For anybody to have any responsibility whatsoever for our legal system, for our moral values to mean anything at all, we must possess free will. Otherwise, it's all just going through the motions, as it were.
So in terms of a causal chain, do you believe that the causal chain is somehow broken by free will?
No. Free will is the inception of the causal chain. And the causal chain is shaped like a loop. In other words, basically, free will is like the center of a loop, as it were.
Okay. Then are we in some sense first movers?
Are we in some sense, excuse me?
First movers?
Yes. Every person, like the Almighty, like God himself, is a first mover. Basically, okay. Your powers of inception owe to the fact that you are a generator of telesis.
Very interesting.
Being, of course, the power to self-configure, which the universe has because there's nothing external to configure it.
Okay, now, coming back to this issue of truth, can you tell me where, for you, truth falls on the hierarchy of ideals? As in, is there anything more important than truth itself?
Well, of course, truth has content. It's meaningless to say true. You've got to say true has an argument. You've got to say true, parentheses. Stick something in the parentheses, otherwise truth itself is meaningless. Well, it's not entirely meaningless. You could say that it amounts to self-consistency. In a sense, this is the most important thing because it's the highest identity on a lattice, on a kind of an arrangement of attributes. It's the highest attribute, the attribute that distributes over all of reality. And once again, as I pointed out before, this is because truth and reality are really synonymous. So, yes, okay. Truth is in a way the highest attribute, just like reality is the highest attribute. Anything external to reality is irrelevant to reality, and you might as well not even talk about it. So it's the first requirement of discourse.
Okay, very good. Well, I'm going to move on to one of our questions from one of our participants. Mike in California asks, he says, Stephen Hawking has said humanity doesn't have more than 500 years left, and we need to find another planet. Do you, Chris, think humans can save themselves, or does he think, or do you think we need divine or perhaps even alien help and intervention in order to survive our own self-destructiveness?
Well, that's kind of a loaded question because in order to really take it seriously, I have to admit that I believe in aliens. And aliens may indeed exist. A metaphysician can't have a closed mind about such things. As a matter of fact, in all likelihood, they do exist. But can man do it himself? Absolutely. The question is, does man have the discipline to do it himself? Does man really want to be saved badly enough to manifest that discipline and to behave responsibly instead of just going after what he wants and satisfying his momentary wants and desires? This is the question. And it is my hope that mankind actually can manifest this discipline and will be allowed to manifest this discipline by the people who run things, who seem to be determined at times to keep man in a state of panic, worrying about whether he can survive from one moment to the next. So my hope is definitely that, yes, we can save ourselves, and the secret to that, the key to that, is truth. We need to understand our own nature and the nature of reality. Science and metaphysics together.
Very good. I hope so, too. Now we're going to turn to one of our callers, Tim. Tim, welcome to the show. Please state your name and put your question out there to Chris.
Hi, this is Tim from Boston, Massachusetts. My question is about a famous Hi, my question is about a famous unsolved problem in computer science called the P versus NP problem. This is considered to be one of the most important problems in all of mathematics. There's a $1 million prize for solving it offered by the Clay Mathematics Institute. Some time ago, Chris, you put a paper online in which you give some background about this problem, which you call the first part of a much longer work in progress. So I'm curious, so I want to ask, have you worked on the P versus NP problem? And if so, do you think you can solve it?
Well, yes, I have worked on the PNP problem. As a matter of fact, I did some work on the PNP problem recently. And as far as solving it is concerned, in other words, can I prove that P does not equal NP? Yes, I think I probably can. However, there's something you have to remember about the Clay Prize, and that is that Andrew Weil, who's, I guess, on the committee there, said that he and his fellow committee members are convinced that no academic outsider has a chance of solving any of these problems. Thus, I'm unlikely to be taken seriously if I send a solution in to the Clay Prize Committee. They'll basically, well, who's this guy? Well, basically circular file this thing. This is what they do. It's not right that they do this, but as a matter of fact, they are they're quite priggish about things like that. So, in other words, I don't know, it's 50-50. Would they pay any attention to a solution by me? Maybe. But, that 50% chance that they just circular file it and wouldn't really pay attention to it would make it a complete waste of time for me, and I'm a very busy guy.
Okay, I think Chris cut out.
Does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you for the answer.
Okay, very good. Well, let's see here. If you've just tuned in, this is the People Speak Radio Show with your guest, JT, on BBS Radio Network. And we're talking with our guest, Christopher Langan. This is all very interesting. I'm so delighted to be talking with you. It sounds like we could perhaps talk forever and ever. I'm hoping that one day you might consider returning as a guest as well, just to make sure I put that out there. I've got another question. This is from Red in Kentucky. He says, have you looked into alternative claims about the events of 9/11? And what do you make of those claims in your understanding of those events?
Well, all I can say about 9/11 is I have a lot of unanswered questions about it. I don't think we've gotten the whole story. I don't think it was properly investigated. Of course, I understand there are a lot of people out there who think that 9/11 was an inside job, and I don't think that we have the data to make a definitive statement one way or another. But there are some things about the incident that I find extremely suspicious. All these buildings falling down at free fall speed, and building number 7, and how these guys with just a little bit of flight training managed to pilot these jumbo jets into without missing the towers completely, and fact that the steel was melting and kerosene doesn't burn. I mean, of course, we've all heard these things, and they are highly suspicious. So let's just say that I'm somewhat suspicious about 9/11, especially insofar as it turned out to be the pretext for a lot of political moves that were made soon thereafter. For example, the Patriot Act. Does that answer your question?
Well, it's not my question. It's Red's in Kentucky, and I'm trusting that it does. He is free to come back with a follow-up if you like there, Red. Okay, we'll go on to Ken in Ohio. He says, Chris, do you believe that the past advanced civilizations once inhabited the Earth we live on now?
I think it's quite possible that that may have happened. I mean, the Earth's crust is moving all the time. We've got these great tectonic upheavals that happen occasionally, and it would probably be geologically possible for the Earth to transform itself in such a way that an entire situation was past civilization was completely wiped out without a trace. And I consider that to be definitely possible. Of course, if you want to talk about things like the myth of Atlantis and where some of these undersea marvels that they've found recently come from and what they consisted of. Well, once again, I don't have the data to make a definitive statement on that. Let's just say that it's all in the realm of possibility. I think that there could have been a past civilization that was as advanced as our own is right now, in principle.
Okay, very good and very interesting. We're going to go to a caller now. This would be John in Missouri on line 2.
Hi, Chris. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay, forgive me if my voice is shaky. I'm 18 years old, and I've been reading the CTMU for years. I've read The Cheating Millennium like 10 times. I spend all of my time doing this. And one thing I really wanted to know is that you said you were working on a book in which you would provide 3 mathematical proofs of the existence of God. I imagine that has something to do with the fact that, like you mentioned in your paper and some of your essays, the self-referential aspect of reality gives it some general analogs of human self-awareness. And I wondered exactly when you would publish the mathematical proofs themselves, because I've been curious about the more specifically logico-mathematical properties of SCSPL, as you mentioned in the introduction to SCSPL in the CTMU. But it's not, as you said, in the CTMU, it's only an introduction, and so I'm just curious as to when, you know, we'll get more details on it, if that's clear.
Well, first, let me thank you for your interest in my theory and for the fact that you've been following it for so many years. Thanks for hanging in there. Secondly, I'm working not just on one book, but on several books on various levels of sophistication. The simplest one, I mean, it's done right now. Basically, what I'm doing is trying to figure out how to print, publish, and distribute this book optimally, and how to promote it, because as it stands right now, I'm doing almost everything myself. As I say, as a matter of fact, I've rewritten that book, I'd say, a dozen times, trying to make it clearer, more concise, so that people can get to it more and more easily. Suffice it to say that there is no doubt, in my mind at least, that the existence of God can be absolutely proven mathematically. Of course, if we define God as the ultimate reality, this is the same as saying that we can develop a theory of reality that has the property of certainty, and that's what the CTMU is. So let me congratulate you on your good taste. You've actually chosen a very good theory to fixate on and to read a lot about, because it's the future. It's the future of metaphysics and quite possibly physics as well.
Okay. Thank you very much, Chris.
You're very welcome.
Yes, thank you. All right, well, let's go to another caller. Hopefully we'll get this done before the break. This would be Charles in Washington on line 3. Charles, please state your question. Go ahead.
Howdy, I'm Charles. First, I could say thank you for your work. I really appreciate it as well. I've been following it for a while. And I'm a practicing physicist who actually finds a lot of value in reading the CTMU to help clarify my own thoughts in my profession. And specific to physics, I'd like to know what your thoughts are and how you think the CTMU can directly address the free will loophole for superdeterminism in Bell's theorem.
The free will loophole, now please explain that again.
There's a loophole in Bell's test of Bell's theorem that the universe has, quote-unquote, conspired either in the past or in the future into more or less cause entanglement in particles measured in the experiment. And people try to rule it out, but I think the CTMU would have a lot to say about that particular experiment.
So in quantum non-locality, there are still degrees of freedom. You might be able to tell the state of one twinned particle that is distant from another one from measuring particle A and knowing immediately that particle B has to be in a complementary state, have opposite spin, right?
Yes.
But that doesn't tell you anything about the state in which you measure particle A. In other words, there's still a great deal of freedom there. So that freedom, if you know how to do it, can actually be cast as an elementary form of free will. In other words, quantum uncertainty is not impaired by Bell's theorem or by quantum non-locality. Also, it is not impaired by entanglement, right? Things can become entangled in many different ways, and it's not necessarily determined prior to entanglement how that's going to occur. Does this answer your question?
Right. I think so. I have to read the CTMU a bit more. I think it has to do with this superdeterminism that somehow provides a loophole to, So what you mentioned is correct in terms of experiments for quantum mechanics. And people say that in the Bell's theorem, that somehow the universe could somehow conspire in the past or in the future to result in the entanglement. But that's right.
You're talking about back causation, retro causation, and that kind of thing.
Exactly. Yep. I think it's
In other words, that's basically comes down to a Wheeler's observer participation. Yes, this is all part and parcel of the CTMU. Yeah. Matter of fact, one could say that this is elementary in the CTMU. It's the very starting point.
Okay. That sounds good. I'll reiterate it, and I appreciate the words. So thank you.
Okay, thank you very much.
Yes, thank you, Charles. And we're going to go to a break right now. We'll be right back on The People Speak with our guest, Christopher Langan, after this brief message.
Got questions? The library's got answers. And books and magazines and CDs and videos and web access and databases and all sorts of other resources at your library. In a world that's information rich, libraries are information smart. Find the right answer and a whole lot more at your library.
With over 150 million registered users, Pal Talk is the largest video chat community in the world, with over 300 Pal Talk support staff speaking dozens of languages to help you enjoy your online experience. Meet new people across town or country or continent while chatting about your interests. Sing live karaoke, listen to music, join a lively political debate, or play group trivia in one of thousands of chat rooms in various categories from your PC, mobile, or tablet device. Joining Pal Talk is free and easy. Go to paltalk.com and become part of our friendly community today.
In America, most of us have the basics we need to survive. But there are millions of children all over the world who don't. Children who must work instead of going to school. Children who were forced to fight as child soldiers. Children who can't have an ordinary childhood because they lack health care, clean water, or good nutrition. For these children, there is UNICEF. UNICEF works in 157 countries and territories, providing children with what they need to survive and grow. To learn more, visit unicefusa.org or call 1-800-4-UNICEF.
Hello, this is Wesley Snipes. And when I'm divinely inspired and spiritually motivated, I listen to BBSRadio.com.
In a world of abundance, hunger is a crime. When a malnourished child dies, we're all guilty. Yet it happens every 5 seconds. Let's do the right thing. Put hunger away for good. Please. Give to the World Food Program.
This land is your land.
Join us on The People Speak for an hour of live interviews and audience interaction as guests of various organizations share their work and strategies which impact our world and make a difference. That's The People Speak every Tuesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Pacific, 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern on the BBS Radio Network.
This land was made for you.
Okay, if you've just joined us, this is the People Speak Radio Show with your host, JT, on BBS Radio Network. And we're talking with our special guest, Christopher Langen. Now we have Victor on the line from California, and he's on line four. Victor, go ahead with your question, please.
My question for Chris is, could the universe and all the laws of physics and God come from nothing or unbound telesis because of positive matter, energy, and negative gravitational energy?
I'm sorry, I had a hard time hearing that. Maybe the telephone connection. Could you please repeat that question a little bit louder?
Okay. Could the universe and the laws of physics and God have come from nothing or unbound telesis because of positive matter energy and negative gravitational energy?
Well, you say because of positive energy and negative gravitation, of course, that's kind of putting the cart before the horse. Gravitation and energy in all of its forms comes from the original formation of the universe from unbound telesis. Now, when you call unbound telesis nothing, unbound telesis is a complete lack of constraint. It's kind of an informational version of nothing. Usually nothing is the absence of something. Unbound telesis is the absence of information. And so, yes, you've got the connection right. But try not to put the cart before the horse and say that somehow the interaction of gravity with positive energy is causing this. In reality, it would be determined as a correlation of gravity, energy, and all the other elementary forces of the universe. And as a matter of fact, everything else as well. Does that answer your question?
Does that mean it... I was just wondering about the Big Bang, and, like, did it come... Was the universe... Well, do you believe in the Big Bang?
Let's just put it... The Big Bang is an extremely dense state of high energy and a very small scale. It's an event on the smallest possible scale at the highest possible energy, right? And, yes, I do believe in a logical analog of that. But it is not essentially a primarily physical state. It's a metaphysical state, which is one of the reasons that physicists can't regress to the Big Bang itself. They can only get, you know, so far away from it before their theories break down. And that's because what they really have to do to regress all the way to the instant of creation is explain the inception of physics itself. Now, physics, you know, the study, the science of physics, is not itself a physical observable. So physics can't do that, and this is why it's breaking down. The reason is primarily logical rather than physical. Does that help?
So what does that have to do in terms of, yeah, it kind of does, but what does that have to do in terms of, like, elementary particles and laws of physics?
Well, it has a great deal to do with it. Of course, that's rather complex. You know, the whole idea is that as the universe cools, you get broken symmetries. If you regress, going back towards the instant of time, those symmetries actually arise. Things come together, converge on commonalities, until finally you get all the way back to one comprehensive distributive identity. And this is, of course, what most people call quantum gravity. It's the idea of working gravity in with the other elementary forces. But the CTMU takes a logical perspective on all this. And all of the physical things that happen are basically outcomes of logical structure. Now, does that help? Does that clarify at all?
Yeah, that helps. Thank you.
Okay, you're welcome.
Okay, for those that might be interested in calling in and talking with our guest, Christopher Langen, you have the chance to call in and talk with him personally. And our toll-free number in the United States and Canada is 888-429-5471. Get ready to write it down. I'll give it one more time, 888-429-5471. I'm going to go to a texted question. This one's from Julia in Germany. She says, Chris, you were talking about mankind having to find the will to save the planet as, at the moment, rather than the people, it's big money and corporations having big influence on the governments and the media. Do you think, in order to save the human race from destroying itself, there has to be a revolution?
There has to be some kind of revolution, yes. There has to be an ideological revolution. People have to experience a revolution in understanding. Does this necessarily mean that there will be a violent physical revolution? Well, I hope not, because at this point in time, such a revolution would be very costly indeed. So what I'm hoping, and just about everybody else, I think, is probably hoping, is that this can all be done through a mass awakening. An awakening that includes the elite, that includes the heads of these corporations, and will cause them to stop interfering and tampering with the evolution of mankind in a deleterious way that actually turns us away from the correct path, which is what they're doing now. To this extent, I agree with you that we have a problem. Once again, I think the way to solve this problem is to distribute the proper knowledge, and once people possess this knowledge, I think that it will be much easier for them to take charge of their own destiny and throw off these corporate masters and these frauds who are claiming to, or who are pretending to be able to chart our destiny without knowing the first thing about what they're doing, which is actually what's occurring right now.
Okay, very interesting. Thank you. We're going to go to one of our callers now. Abraham in California is on line two. Go ahead, Abraham.
Hello, Chris. I'm familiar with your work over the last few decades. You had mentioned in one of your early papers that CTMU involves theories of computation, physics, type theory, and decision theory. And you've also written a paper toward a theory of economic relativity. Now, I'm aware that unbridled capitalism is not the solution for the future, and neither is pure communism. However, do you see a change in the monetary system in the coming decades as a means towards facilitating better decision-making in society?
Yes. As you know, money is really a concretized, a standardized utility. And utility comes out of game theory and decision theory. It's basically what makes things rational. You've got to maximize utility. That way you come up with rational behavior. Now, the monetary economy right now is not necessarily rational except for the people who control it. You've got a number of central bankers who have charge of the money supply, and they basically determine what money gets used for simply because they have so darned much of it. This degree of centralization over the money supply allows them to take the standardized utility that money should be and actually usurp it and displace it and insert their own utility instead. I'd love to talk to some of these guys and have them tell me, no, you know, basically we're not just inserting our own utility in place of the general welfare. We really care about everybody, and it's only a temporary appearance, and here's where it's all leading, and here's where we're all going to end up, and it's going to be some kind of fantastic utopia. Right? I'd love to have them tell me that, but they're not. They're really very secretive about it. They're highly competitive, and they don't like to share their information or anything about where they're going. But this idea that money is standardized utility, in a sense, makes it the property of all mankind, because we all participate in that utility. You can't let any tiny little handful of people control it unless they can establish right up front, by telling the truth to everybody, that they have the knowledge really to arbitrate what utility is and what is useful to the human race and where the human race should be going. So yes, to that extent, we're going to need a change. It's going to have to be a relatively big change, and I think that people are wising up to this situation, and that's where we're headed.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Yes. Now, if you've just joined us, folks, this is the People Speak Radio Show with your host, JT, on BBS Radio Network. And we're talking with our guest, Christopher Langen. I have another text question for you, Chris. This question is, do you think thorium reactors are the future of energy production in this world and are possible replacements for nuclear reactors?
You know, I've heard some good things about thorium reactors, but really what I'm interested in, you know, the thing that's the matter with nuclear power is originally when it was put forth, everybody knew there was going to be this nuclear waste and it was going to be extremely hazardous to everybody, but there was all this talk of closing the fuel cycle. Basically, there was supposed to be different kinds of reactors and you were supposed to be able to burn a certain kind of fuel in one reactor and then take the depleted fuel from that reactor and stick it in another kind of reactor and all the way around until either the fuel was completely depleted and not radioactive at all, or you could feed it back into the first reactor. And that's called closing the fuel cycle. Well, the fuel cycle never got closed. So really the premise that nuclear power was safe turned out to be a big fat fraud. It's completely fraudulent. Nuclear power is one of the most devastatingly dangerous things on this planet right now. We can't dispose of the waste. Just take a look at Fukushima, Chernobyl, other disasters that we've had. I mean, the Chernobyl was allegedly responsible for 1 million deaths, over 1 million deaths. And Fukushima is exponentially worse than that. So really, we need to get real about nuclear power. We need to either establish that the fuel cycle can be closed, and this would apply to thorium reactors as well, or we need to get away from it. I mean, we'd almost be better off with coal than with nuclear power, because this stuff has a half-life of some of these byproducts of tens of thousands of years. Does that answer your question?
I see. Yeah, that was not my question, but I think you did very well answer it. Thank you. That question was anonymous.
Yes, you did. You introduced that as a texted question. So believe me, Jay, I know that these questions aren't yours, that they're coming from other people.
Yes.
But I was kind of thinking that maybe the author of the question would be on the phone somewhere. That's not
no,
true.
That one just came in on text.
Well, yeah, are so you receiving these texts on a telephone, on a smartphone?
I'm getting these texts over the PalTalk program, and so they're being forwarded to me. I'm not getting follow-ups on the text questions.
Okay, my mistake.
No problem. I will go to a caller, though, where we can get follow-ups. This would be Tim in Boston, line 3. Go ahead, Tim.
Looks like Tim got lost.
Yeah, we're going to go with Danielle from Maryland, line 4.
Hello? Hello?
Is this Danielle?
Yeah, speaking.
Go ahead.
Oh, hi. I'm so honored to speak to you, Chris. I've been reading many of your theories and stuff for the past like 7 years. I have like 100 different questions to ask you, but I guess one of them would be what happened before I was born, and what's going to happen to me after I died. That's just one of the many questions I have. I know this is not the only reality that I have, but and also before I was born, did this, like, Earth and all the other countries even exist? Or, because I know there's a subjective aspect to reality.
And to time. Right? In other words, there's nothing in principle that would stop your memories from being generated retrospectively from your current awareness of what's going on around you. Yeah, that's true. Time, you can play certain tricks with time like that. As for where you came from and where you're going after you exit this mortal coil, well, you are an endomorphic image of God. After you exit this mortal coil, you will be retracted upward along the mapping that created you, and you will have a chance to reunite with God. And if your soul has not been interdicted by some kind of atrocious bad behavior or recusance or unwillingness to get with teleology, then you will be reunited with God. God lives forever.
But ultimately,
there's no such thing as death here for anybody.
Everyone will know the absolute truth of the universe at some point in time in the future.
Excuse me, repeat that? I'm getting some kind of beeping on this phone that is interrupting your voice.
Oh, but at some point down the line, everyone will realize, like, absolute truth and live in harmony.
Yes, absolutely. Everybody will realize this because we're going to publish it and put it out there, so everybody's going to have access to it. Whether they would figure it out for themselves, that's not necessarily given.
Oh, like I mean, like, after I die, like, when after everyone dies, and at some point, my soul will understand absolute truth. Okay. Eventually, like, it will be with teleology or something? Or...
Well, teleology is more or less synonymous with the will of God, right? It's the intentionality of the identity of the universe, and the universe can't actually be ascribed its own form of intentionality. And so, yes, by getting with teleology, I mean making yourself and your own intentionality consistent with. Okay. Little phone mishap there. But does that answer your question?
Okay, we're going to drop that caller. I think we're having some sound issues with his phone. And we'll go ahead and move on to Jeremy from Michigan on line two, please.
Hey, it's Bakian from Pale Talk. I got a question for you, Chris. Do you believe in a personal or an impersonal God? And can you give a reason as to why you hold to that position? And do you hold to any particular religion, or do you consider yourself kind of an eclectic?
As far as my religious affiliation, it's like I've said before, I'm a respecter of all religions. Out here where we live, there are all of the churches are Christian churches, so when I go to church, it's a Christian church. The first part of your question, refresh my memory, please.
Do you believe in a personal or an impersonal God, and can you provide...
Well, I believe that there's a mapping between God and secondary images of God in this universe, and it is a one-to-many mapping. So on the many end of the mapping, that is, in the codomain of the mapping, God is personal. On the other end of the mapping, God is impersonal in the sense that he has a personal relationship with all of his images. Right, so in a way, you can characterize his state as being an intersect of all of those images.
Okay, so you hold on to a similar view that the Hindus do, that there's the Brahman, the impersonal source, and then perhaps like a lord like a Yahweh or a Shiva that is kind of like a personality?
What I'm saying is that God is essentially personal because God is projecting himself into each person. You understand, God is being realized as each individual person, and to this extent, God is very, very definitely personal. In other words, what I'm trying to say is that we each have an aspect of God inside us.
Okay, but
that doesn't necessarily mean we are God, because, of course, we're only localized here. We're only a partial aspect of God. But to the extent that we are up to isomorphism equivalent to God in the sense of this mapping, then yes, God is absolutely personal. And it's like I say, your soul is a connection to the unary identity of the universe, so you can be retracted up to the Godhead itself, which would seem to indicate that it's not all that impersonal. I mean, if a personal human being, if the codomain of the mapping can be retracted into the domain, then the personalities of which it consists can also be retracted into the domain, and that means that God is personal. Although there's quite a lot of impersonal... God is syntactic. In other words, God consists of invariants that do not vary as we permute different people, different personalities among each other. In other words, God remains the same from all of our perspectives, and to this extent, so I suppose really what it depends on is how you define impersonal. If by impersonal you mean invariant, then yes, God has invariant aspects, but he's also got variable aspects that match the personalities of individual human beings.
Okay. Let me word it this way. Do you believe that there's a God that hears prayer, that can communicate people with people in a language that they know, that cares about what we do in our life, that has a purpose for us? Do you believe in this type of God?
Yeah, you better believe I do. Absolutely, I do.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
But I also believe in Einstein's God, or almost a, you know, I'm not a deist, but there is this idea of a God of nature, and I believe in that God too. I believe in both of them, and this is part of how God is. The fact that God has both of these aspects is how he is defined in the CTMU.
Okay. Now, can we have access?
There turns out to be no logical contradiction there, by the way. It's all perfectly consistent.
Okay, but can we have a personal relationship with this God apart from the blood of Jesus Christ?
Absolutely. There is no doubt about that. You can interpret the entirety of Christian scripture in the CTMU. You can also do that for other religions, interestingly enough. That's what makes CTMU theological special.
All right, thanks for taking my question. I appreciate it.
You're very welcome.
Thank you, Jeremy. Boy, this hour has gone so very quickly. I hope that, Chris, you will consider returning to our show. You have been such a wonderful guest. This is JT on The People Speak, thanking our guest, Christopher Langen. And you can learn more about Chris and his work at his website, ctmu.org. And look out for Chris's new book, which comes out shortly. I'm not sure, maybe you could chime in as to when you expect that to come out there, Chris?
The timing is still a little bit up in the air, but we'll certainly, if you like, we can schedule another interview then. I would certainly love to, and this has been a pleasure for me.
That would be wonderful. Thank you so much. And thanks to our engineer, Don Newsom, and all of you listening out there. Our guest next week is Hedy Epstein. Now, she's a 90-year-old Holocaust survivor, and she has comments on the Gaza and Israel issue. And good night to all.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the steeple by the relief office, I saw my people, and they stood there hungry, and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is your land, this land is my land, from California to the New York Island, Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. Yeah, this land is made for you and me.